Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 6th, 2002. This session is Communal Spiritual Discernment, Integration and Shared Wisdom, How to Discern the Spirits Leading in the Group. Your presenter is Gary Gwaffweiler. And you can find this in the tape library or order it under the heading GRG 2002-06. Let's listen in.
No, Jesus said some people have eyes, but they don't see. Mm-hmm. Ears to hear. Okay. Heart. The center of the person. Center of the person. To love. And then how about the last verse? What's different about the last one? Yeah.
What did you say?
God responds.
God responds. Yeah. God's answering us. Mm-hmm. So, and if you're walking and you want to do this, you can just touch your eyes, open my eyes, Lord. Open my ears, Lord. Open my heart, Lord. And it's a great way to pray with your body, not just with your mouth or in your mind. Okay, Steve, I think we're ready to go, and thank you for helping us taping back there. Is today September 6th? Isn't it? Okay. This is a session on communal discernment, and it's the last in a series that I'm doing on paying attention to God. My name is Gary Gwaffweiler, and I'm a Lutheran pastor who just retired a year ago in Bellingham, Washington. So I just want to say a couple things about discernment. Discernment is Christian decision-making, and it's a graced ability, and it's a lost art, and the church is recovering it. And someone asked me, in one of the other sessions, well, couldn't I go to my pastor for spiritual discernment? Perhaps. But you might go to your doctor. Or you might go to a Roman Catholic nun. Not everyone has this gift, not everyone cultivates it, but all of us can to some extent. We are called to be in relationship with God. And we're called to be open to the God of our felt experience, that's what Ignatius says, and also the God of the gathering or the community. And it's hard to do communal discernment if you don't do personal discernment. If you're not praying personally, it's hard to be praying with other people and try and figure out what God is calling you to be and do as God's people. It's possible to discern the will of God and say no. Okay? No, thank you. Okay? We can know what God wants and we can say no. But part of what Ignatius says is if we're growing in Christ, if we're growing as a Christian, then hopefully we're growing in purity of heart and we're growing in what Ignatius calls holy indifference. That means holding things lightly, not insisting on our own way, a sort of disinterestedness, a desire really to want what God wants. That's what discernment's about, to want what God wants for yourself. And if it's communal discernment, for the church. And to respond with mind, body, and spirit. To respond with your whole self. Here's a little quote from a Benedictine. Communal discernment is seeking the will of God and the ability to let go as you weigh your own personal wisdom with the wisdom of the community. Communal discernment is seeking the will of God and the ability to let go as you discover your own personal wisdom and the wisdom of the gathered community. Now, how many of you are part of a congregation? Okay, great. What kinds of major decisions, where there's been a division of the house, okay, have you been part of in a congregation?
Type of worship, style of worship.
The style of worship, okay, that would be one. Not everybody likes their worship rare. Some people like it well done, you know, and a little in between. What would be another decision?
My congregation is between pastors, so we're having to decide who the next pastor should be.
So when you're in a vacancy, calling a pastor, okay, certainly a big one. What would another one be?
We started a Hispanic ministry as part of our congregation. A choice to call it the Spanish-speaking part of Claremont Lutheran,
okay,
and an English-speaking part,
okay,
but one congregation, not two.
How exciting!
And that caused a rift in the church. Some people leaving as a result.
Yeah.
Was it to build a new church or to send off a mission congregation?
Whether to build a new sanctuary, or a larger sanctuary maybe, or complex, or to birth a new congregation. Good, yeah, those are some biggies. Now, I want to ask two more questions. What did you do in that process that was helpful? And what did you do that was not helpful? Did you learn anything? So let's take the not helpful first. What did you do that was not helpful?
Talking and talking and talking and not doing anything, getting anything done.
Great. People get tired. And you can kind of ground people, you can grind people down. And people who are really a tenacious minority know that. So they can wait till the majority is just, oh gosh, we can't deal with this anymore. And then they go ahead, okay? And that's true in politics too. You know, it doesn't take a lot of people to make a shift somehow, okay? So talking and talking, dragging it out, anything else that wasn't helpful.
Maybe the opposite of that, making a decision without any input.
Great.
Or too soon.
Making a decision too soon, not getting everybody on board, not sharing all the information, okay, not hearing everybody. Yeah. Yeah, someone was saying that I was visiting with last night, that after September 11th, he really felt called to press the Holden Winter community to come out with a statement. And they got into the process, and he said to somebody, we're not going to be able to pull it off. It's too soon, you know. We're not on the same page. Yeah. Anything else that didn't work? Let's try it. Or that wasn't helpful.
I was on a vestry about 15 years ago when we called a new rector. And there were two very dominant personalities that basically pushed their choice. And I think that the vestry should have pulled back, asked for more breathing room, maybe even for more candidates. Because it turned out to be a very disastrous choice.
So there's just to write him out.
And I don't think there was enough prayer on the part of the individual vestry members.
Yeah.
I just don't. It was much more political and business-like than prayerful.
So two people kind of pushed through their candidate, okay. Yeah, that can happen. And I can remember Bruce Foreman, who's a Methodist pastor and who was leading a group. This was years and years ago when I was at PLU for a leadership training event. And he said, if you don't like what's happening in a group, stop the process. Stop the train. tell other people what you're thinking and what you're feeling, because there may be other people in the group who are uncomfortable with the process. And if we smile to each other and nod while we're grinding our teeth and our stomach is churning, you know, it goes ahead and then it comes back to bite us. It comes back to bite us. You know, we live in a culture that wants to make decisions quickly.
Yes.
And so part of the key in communal discernment is taking time to hear people, taking time to pray, taking time to kind of share information, you know, and it takes time. And it's hard work. It's hard work to listen to other people and also be in touch with God and yourself. Now I'm going to just flip it and say, in making a major decision in a faith community that you were a part of, what was helpful? This is on communal discernment. Okay? What was helpful? Were there any things that you did or someone else did that was helpful to you?
One thing that we're trying to do is to keep the anxiety level down by not overreacting to people's comments.
Good. I can remember one of our campus pastors who said, and I love this and I use it a lot, he said, anxiety is like a virus. You can catch it. And if you know systems theory for a congregation or an organization, you know, if we're like we're connected in a big web, those people say the people that are the most fused to the organization get the most anxious when there's change. Mm-hmm. Because they're not sure if they'll still have power, or they will still have voice, or they will still be heard, or there will even be a place for them. And so part of the role of leadership when you're doing communal discernment, and I think even membership, and it, not necessarily ordained leadership, is to be a non-anxious presence in an anxious situation. You know, and people are saying, have you heard? You know, if you can take three breaths and just say, let me know your peace while you're listening to this person. And just let go of the anxiety. Let me know your peace. Let go of the anxiety. Let me know your peace. Let go of the anxiety. Yeah. Anything else you've done in a major decision in your faith community that was helpful? That was helpful.
Did a lot of pre-event publicity and making sure that everyone knew about what was
great. Boy, you can't withhold information when you're doing a major decision. That's a power move. And the more information that you can put out for folks so they can be informed and they can think, well, how do I respond to this opportunity personally, and how do we respond? Yeah, it saves a lot of trouble down the road. Well, I want to talk about communal discernment a little bit from Ignatius. Okay? And what Ignatius said was that it's important to do some pre-work before you make a decision. It's important to do some pre-work or predispositions. And I'm just going to share with you some of the things, some of the little points that he suggested and Jesuits use. And I'm a Christian Lutheran. I'm not Roman Catholic. But I figure you steal from the best, you know. And we can learn from each other in the body. So he suggested these were some pre-notes. One, that when we are open to God's action in our life, we are not uptight, we are free. We have a sense of freedom. We have a sense that we are where God wants us to be and who God wants us to be. He also suggested that we take time to be open to holy things. To be open to holy things. That may be to sit with a crucifix. That may be to sit in front of the altar or a statue of Jesus on the cross. That may be to really kind of pay attention to what God is saying through another person. He also said that it's important to be self-critical. Not negative, but self-critical. And to tell other people what's going on inside of us. So if we're afraid, to say we're afraid. If we're unsure, to say we're unsure. If we need more time, to say we need more time. If we're tired, to say we're tired. He also said that it's important to have a generosity of mind and heart in the group. So we open ourselves up to the group. It was really interesting in watching one of our faculty who just left today, who's a psychiatrist, is he would make presentations and then he would share some of his dark side, some of his shadow. He'd say, you ever remember when you were raising teenagers and how they were pushing against you and you just got more and more uptight and more rigid and you were on the edge of shouting? Well, no one else in the group would say that, but he did, see? So he was modeling for the group. He was being kind of transparent. Ignatius also said it's important to take time and space to pray. He also said that we should put, and this sounds like Luther and I think it's the Eighth Commandment. He said we should put the best interpretation on anything anyone is saying as we are listening.
Oh, that's so hard.
Yeah.
That is hard. Yeah. You know, particularly if you had words in the past or it's not resolved or you know they're against it and you're for it. Yeah. Because part, again, of what we're after is listening to the Spirit in the group, the God of the gathered, as well as the God of our own felt experience. This is one that's hard for me. He said it's also important to have a balanced set of detachment for the sake of the group. And what that means is, you are willing to give up your opinions for the sake of the group. You state them, or your position, but you're willing to lay those down. So you need to know where the Spirit is leading you, and you need to know where the Spirit is leading us. And I can remember in a congregation that I just retired from, that there was a man, David. We were growing rapidly, and we'd outgrown our building. And David wanted us to seed a new congregation. And he said we should just, at the next congregational dinner, put a picture of a baby under every fourth plate. And all those people who got a baby would be part of birthing the new church. Yeah, exactly. And so some people started to hiss, and so he realized that was not being well received by the community. And he said, I think that we shouldn't put more money into bricks and mortar and structure, but we should birth a new congregation. And I feel like I'm not being listened to, and I'm thinking about going somewhere else.
Oh, the threat.
Exactly. Exactly. A little blackmail. And he said, I will take my money with me.
Right. Oh.
And I wish someone would have said, David, I couldn't do this, you know. But I wish someone would have said, David, what's the Spirit behind that?
Mm-hmm.
comment.
Control.
You know, is that the spirit of Christ? Mm-hmm. Is that the spirit of God? Or is that your own spirit? And what David came to realize eventually was that the congregation was moving in a different direction than he wanted it to. And he ended up joining, he and his wife ended up going to a smaller congregation. And I think, you know, their parting was not as good as I would have hoped, because they sort of went out like skunks. You know, they just kept spraying. And then they'd come back and they'd spray. You know, they didn't go and stay gone, but they, you know, they'd meet someone in the store and they'd say, "How are you doing? Spray, spray."
So, was that the best thing for them to do?
Oh, they're happiest clams. They are big fish in a small pond.
Uh-huh.
See, and they couldn't be big fish in a large pond.
Right.
But they're, yeah, they're really... They're right at the core of the leadership. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, they love Jesus and they're where they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the predispositions. Now I want to talk, I want to share with you three things that Ignatius said it's important to do if you have a spiritual discernment group. And you don't do spiritual discernment on all decisions. But I think that any faith community probably is wise if they look for and constitute a group that works with spiritual discernment. I mean, you can't do spiritual discernment with 400 people. I mean, it's too hard. It really is too hard. You have to some degree. But you need a core group to sort the wheat from the chaff and bring it to the larger group. And then talk about it with them and explain and let them pray and process. But this is what he says. So, for example, if your spiritual discernment group is the board of the village or some of the faculty of the village or part of a church council and leadership that's off the vestry, you know, former leadership, or members who've never been publicly guiding the body, but who you think are people of wisdom. He says it's important to do three things. Number one, to do some autobiographical sharing, to share with one another, 8, 10, 12 people, your story. What kind of background you came from. I came from a non-practicing Roman Catholic background and an active Lutheran background. Who influenced you the most? My mother? My grandmother? Who are your wisdom figures? My fifth grade Sunday school teacher? My confirmation pastor? How did you learn? Who are the peers that influenced you? What do you wish to accomplish in life? Who are the significant influences in your adult life? My wife, I'd say, above all. How did your wisdom figures shape your affective self? Not your thinking self, but your feeling self. Who were the people that had the most impact on who influences you now? Friends, children, spouse? How's the aging process been for you? See, that's all part of our story. You know, I'm on trifocals now. Okay. I've had 3 surgeries on my knees, so I don't run anymore. What are your deepest values in terms of life experience? So it's sharing some of your story. See, obviously you can't do this real quickly. Secondly, sharing about who God is for you and what God does for you. What does God mean to you? What does it mean for you to call yourself a Christian? What does it mean for you to follow Jesus? How have you grown in the Spirit's leading? I said to someone I was eating lunch with recently, how are you different since I saw you last year? And she said, whoa, that's a big question. And then she said, you know, I've got a handle on my depression. And I'm a happier person. And I know what I'm going to do when I leave the village. And I thought, she put it out there for me, you know? How do I talk about the challenges God brings to me? How does God challenge me through the group or my felt experience? What kind of God do I pray for? How do I pray? I can remember a man who became an antagonist to me. And I asked him one time in a council meeting, I said, how do you pray, Robert? And he said, I don't pray anymore. He's a council leader and he doesn't pray. You know, and I'm just... And so I sort of drew him out. And eventually he shared with the group how one time he asked a church council to pray the Lord's Prayer as slowly as they could, to think about it. And people laughed at it. And he was a CFO. He was very prominent within the community. And he said, never again will I talk about how I pray with anybody, or even try to pray in public. What are my patterns of consolation and desolation? That's Ignatius. What draws me to God? And what takes me away from God? You know, Ignatius said, often it's the good that gets in the way of the good, not just the bad. That it's the good that can get in the way of the greatest good, which is God. So first sharing your life story, then sharing your faith story, and then talking a little bit about praying about the kingdom. That's the third thing. And he said that includes things like, how do I understand God to be in creation? How do I notice God in creation? And that includes myself. Are there gospel stories that are favorites for me? Are there gospel stories I don't like? You know? What keeps me from following the Spirit? What does the reign of God look like in the world? You know, St. Benedict said, holy work, whatever you do, if you're an engineer, a doctor, a pharmacist, a farmer, holy work always pushes the world toward God's dream. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. Being a mom, being a grandma, holy work moves the world, moves the society toward God's dream. So what do I think God wants the world to be like? Now Ignatius says all this happens before you do communal discernment. See? So you need to take some time. And you need to model this. And this is fairly new for me. And I think often when things are new, it kind of invites people to move out of their place of comfort, and they may get anxious, and there may be resistance. And you may share this with your priest or pastor, and he may say, you know, it's great in an ideal world, but we just can't operate the church like that. Mm-hmm. Well, do we want to try? Do we want to try? Are we willing to stretch a little bit? I'm still here. I'm just looking, Steve, at my notes. I haven't dropped anything. Well, I guess. Okay. Okay, as we move kind of into communal discernment, he said that it's important to ask people to pray for you if you're doing communal discernment, even as you pray for yourself and you pray for the group that's doing the discernment. And again, you don't discern all decisions, but if it's a major sort of decision that has far-reaching implications, you do that. One of the questions you need to ask, Ignatius said, is this for God's glory? Is this for God's glory? I remember a woman who brought her pledge to her priest, happened to be Episcopal, laid it on his desk, and said, here's my pledge. And he just looked up and he said, does it glorify God? And she took it back and walked away.
Interesting.
And so she came back later and she changed her pledge, and again she put it in front of him. And he looked at it and he looked at her and he said, does it glorify God? And she was really getting uptight, you know. So she took the pledge and away she went. You know, and then she came back the third time and she laid it in front of him. And he said, does it glorify God? And she said, it does. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm glad for you. Mm-hmm. See, we don't give to bless the church. We give to glorify God. And we're the first beneficiary when we give. So to ask, you know, does it glorify God? How is this advancing the reign of God? How do we become co-creators with God in this process? And it's important to listen with your mind and your heart to what's going on in you and what's going on in other people. And that takes energy. Ignatius says, the reign of God invites us to bring about justice, reconciliation, peacemaking, care of the earth, a welcome of all. Those are some of the things that come in the reign of God. He says there are four tasks. Gather the data. So get all the information you can, the background, why you're doing this, why we're doing this. Make the resources available to the whole group. Don't withhold information. Then sift through the issues, try and prioritize a little bit, and then try and seek God's will in the third part. Go beyond the arguments and the debate. He says discernment is about God's story and God's spirit in the group. So where is God taking the group? And how is the group story intersecting with God's story? Tell people ahead of time, some decisions will be unpopular. Just say that up front. You know, people don't like conflict in the church. And conflict's always there. It's always there. But you got to manage it. Can't let it get out of control, you know? So he says, is the decision that we're about reflecting gospel values? Is it faithful to Jesus? Is it true to the tradition of the church as we know it and the scriptures? And is it true to our own history as God's people? Then he talks about sharing with each other your biases and your fears. And sometimes asking each other, and this is a great ministry to any parish or faith community leaders that you have. If someone asks a question, you know, there's a way of asking a question that sets people up, you know, versus I'm just asking a question for information. People often did this to Jesus. They baited him. And it's a wonderful gift if there are people in a faith community who would say to the questioner, what's behind your question? They haven't given it. It's okay for them to say they think that they don't want to go in this direction, but don't bait people. You know, if they have a prejudiced point of view, let them get that out. It's important to know each other's fears and biases and desires. He also says it's important to pray daily, to worship weekly, to be in the Word, to maybe fast. Any questions so far? I'm kind of cruising along here.
I have a question.
Do you have a criteria for how you know it's really God's will and not just you?
Well, part of what, part of what Ignatius would say is, is what we're doing glorifying God? Okay. Is it true to the message of the gospel as we know it in Jesus? Is it consistent with the tradition of the church? Or if we're challenging, you know, the Spirit works in the tradition of the church, so it's not fixed. It's not static. It's living. So if we're challenging the tradition of the church, then we need to say we're challenging the tradition of the church.
You know where the rubber hits the road often? The tradition and change really come at each other.
Yeah. But sometimes what's at stake is not the tradition of the church, but local custom. Someone was telling me about when, and I don't know all the details, but her father was a Lutheran pastor, and he had this incredible funeral pall made. And whenever there was a funeral, every casket, wood or bronze, whatever, was covered with this pall. They're all equal under the sign of Christ. And there were four women that had responsibility for this, part of the altar guild. Well, one died, and a second died, and then the third died, and the fourth really didn't care. And then some members of the congregation who were older died in another community, and they asked for the pall to be brought there. And a new pastor said, well, why? You know, it's 160 miles away. I mean, can't you get one from the local Episcopal church? But they wanted their pall. And it got real, real prickly. And that wasn't around the tradition of the church. That was around a local custom. And maybe a pastor who had too much power. You know. Other questions?
When you talk about telling people that you're going to make an unpopular decision,
right,
it might occur.
We will make probably several decisions that people won't be, that not everyone will buy into. Yeah.
If you're working with a smaller group like your church council,
right,
what is your opinion of working with the process until you have a unanimous decision of that body before it's going out?
That's helpful. That's helpful if you can do that, if your vestry and your council are unanimous. But for me, you know, as a body grows, as more people are involved in the decision, some councils are 7, some are 12, some are 15, 20. If you wait for unanimity, you allow any dissenter to roadblock the process of the group. And again, one of the things that Ignatius said about communal discernment, and I sort of like, you know, I like to go for consensus, and I think he likes to go for consensus, but they agree ahead of time that if they don't reach consensus, they believe that the Spirit is leading the majority of the people. And that all the minority opinion, you know, the faithful dissenters, ultimately will go with that. They won't say, well, they won and we lost, but that, no, the Spirit worked through them and the Spirit worked through us. And the Spirit brought them to a different understanding about our mission or our life. But we are part of this community, and so we go with that Spirit. So it's really, it's very communal versus I didn't get my way, so I'm out of here, or I didn't get my way and I'm just gonna spray all over. Were you gonna say something, Dan? Okay. Other questions? Okay. This is a little review. This is from John English, who's a Jesuit. He says, as your experiences are shared, you know, back when you're doing your autobiography, and then you're doing your spiritual autobiography, you're sharing that. He says it's important to look at the experience of the group and to put the history before the group in newsprint. So I love, in the Village Center, here's 40 years of Holden. And here are pictures and experiences and people and themes. And you begin to get a sense of what God has done through this community for 40 years. Who has the oldest memory in the group? Janet Grant came in 1980. So I was able to share some experiences with her from the 60s and the 70s that I remember. I don't remember a lot, but I was able to share some. When did the group come together? Why were they called together? What were the decisive events in the group's life? I'm part of a congregation now where a pastor had an affair with a secretary. And the two of them ran off. And he wasn't disciplined. And his wife remained a member of the congregation. And in some people's minds, it's never been healed. It's never been healed. We're talking 20-some years. You know, congregations have secrets. What are the decisive events? The positive ones, the negative ones. You know, working in a parish, we're an associate. And a lead pastor became antagonists. Oh. And some people were with the lead, and some people were with the associate, and some people wished it wasn't happening in their church, you know. But it was very difficult for the congregation to move ahead until that was processed and there was healing between folks at different places. Ignatius says, when we tell our story, not my story, but when we tell our story, a vision can begin to emerge about where God is leading us. So I was part of a congregation in Portland that first ministered to Swedish Lutherans and then ministered to African Americans. And then ministered to Hispanics. And now has a ministry in Northeast Portland to a large gay and lesbian population. And there are still some Hispanics in the congregation. There are still some African Americans in the congregation. And there are a few, just a few, old Swedish Lutherans. You know? But that's where they come from. See, that's who they are. So where we're going is shaped by that. English talks about, I need to say what's going on in me. Am I experiencing deep sorrow? Am I experiencing deep fear? Am I experiencing deep joy? And everybody else needs to do that. And you need to hear that, and it takes time. And we may hear the voice of the Spirit as the group does that. Have you ever had that happen? Where you're sharing, you're processing, you're praying, you're wrestling, you're waiting, and someone stands up and says something, and it's like, bong! It's like the bell rang. And all of you just sort of know that's the voice of God. And it may not be coming through the pastor. It may be coming through Hilda, who's 87, who's 93 pounds dripping wet, and she puts this out there, and you just sort of intuitively know she's on it, she's got it, and then you need to pay attention to that, in a sense, not ignore that. Where is the Spirit leading us? What's happening to us? Maybe we need to pray more. I can remember serving in a transition ministry while I was a pastor developer in a congregation where the lead pastor had a breakdown. And he was real strong and very, very gifted. And when he broke down, everything began to break down. And I was meeting with our church council, and then we did a retreat, and we'd been really working hard, and toward the end of the retreat, Bob Winograd said, "I think we should have the Eucharist." This was before our Eucharist every Sunday, like it was in the early church, was really the thing that most Christian Lutherans were doing. And I thought, well, I can't think of a good reason why we shouldn't. So we went in the sanctuary, and we and we shared the Eucharist, and it was like we got a whole new burst of energy, bread for the journey. And then we did some really good work when everyone was tired, but we did some really good work to wrap it up. Ignatius said it's important to sense whether a group is in desolation. Whether a group is in desolation or not, spiritual desolation. If a group's in desolation, usually it's weary. People feel hopeless. There's an undercurrent of bitterness and cynicism. There is a tension in the air. When there's desolation, good people move into the woodwork. They just sort of step back. They shut down. They check out. They may be in the room, but they've checked out. When there's desolation, people are defensive about their position rather than simply sharing it. When there's desolation, people are bombarded with rational answers. I think this. You should do that because, da, da, da. Not the Spirit, calls us. He says it's important to do a discernment of spirits, which is different than communal discernment, and to just stop the group and say, where did this start? What happened? Usually somebody got their feelings hurt, or someone thought they weren't heard, or that someone did an end run around them. Where were we not on guard? Where were we not in the Spirit? And do we want to continue as a group? Maybe we can't continue. It's not good to make personal decisions when you're in spiritual desolation. It's not good to make communal decisions when you're in communal desolation. Consolation is a feeling of peace, a feeling of joy, a sense of unity, a respect that kind of holds out to other people. I hear that you're not where most of the group is. Can you share with us why you're not where we are? Can you tell us that? And when a decision's made, always honoring those people, allowing them to have a grace, to know they can still be part of the community, even if 97% of the congregation voted differently, that they're still welcome there. So you embrace them, you keep. And sometimes people just have to leave. Sometimes they have to leave. And that's hard, but then hopefully they will leave gracefully rather than like a skunk. Let me share with you a process. Now, this is a communal discernment process for picking a church council that one of my friends uses. They asked, this is a very large congregation, probably 1,500 families or households. They asked the congregation to nominate people for the church council. Okay. So all these names come in. Maybe 50, 60 names come in. Then they contact all these people and they say, you've been nominated to be on the parish council. Are you open to considering that? Well, maybe 40 out of 60 say we are. Then those 40 are invited together for a day of sharing, faith sharing, and prayer and reflection and conversation. And it involves asking questions like, tell us about who God is for you. Share with us how you pray. What's your ministry in this parish to the present? How do you feel about this mission? And everybody shares that. And as it's sharing, some people just get up and say, I can't do this. And they self-select out. And then there's silence after everybody's shared on one question. You know, how do you pray, or who is God for you, or what does it mean for you to follow Jesus? And then they ask another question, and they go a little deeper. And another question, they go a little deeper. And pretty soon they're down to probably 12. They started with 35 or 40. They're down to 12. They have two vacancies. So now the group is asked, everyone is asked why they feel God is calling them to be a leader at this time, and what are the gifts they bring to the parish council. Everybody shares that, and then they all vote. So say the vote is five for one person and six for another person and one abstention. Then they need to take the two people who they have selected and have them share again what their gifts are, how they feel about the mission, why they want to be part of the parish council. And that's how they work it down. And they're listening to the Spirit. Isn't that a neat way to do it? Instead of taking whoever you can get. You know, it's like driving a car with a flat tire. You know, there have been times in my ministry where we haven't had qualified people, and I've said to the nominating committee, because I use the nominating committee, attitude, aptitude, and availability. Can they give 6 hours a month? Available. Do they have the right aptitude? Are they smart? And do they have the right attitude? Are they open to Christ, open to the mission of the church, and so on? And they'll come back and they'll say, you know, we have 5 vacancies, we've got a 12-person council, and we only have 3. I say, hey, God gave us 3, let's go with the 3. But we got to fill those other 2. I say, no, 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 you can't drive a car with 2 flat tires. You know? Well, wait. Maybe someone new will come into the parish who has gifts and commitment and who's available, and we'll appoint them to fill the vacancy. Jeannie Fox, who's a member at St. Leo's, which is an inner city parish, probably one of the most lively, spirit-filled communities I know that's committed to the city in Tacoma, says these are the things she does. She's on the staff there. She says, first, we listen to ourselves. What am I feeling about this issue? Am I for it or against it? What am I feeling? Secondly, what am I thinking about this issue? Am I for it or against it? Thirdly, I ask others, what are they thinking? What are they feeling? And I try and listen openly. And then thirdly, we pray together. We really ask God to lead us. I'm just going to stop here and see if you have any questions.
Is it the pastor who would lead this process?
Or a facilitator. Or a facilitator.
But not necessarily a member of the congregation.
Could be. Could be if they're trained in group facilitation and if they do discernment or they're familiar with communal discernment. Because again, you aren't just making a decision. You're wanting God's decision for this community at this time in its holy history. Yeah. So sometimes somebody will know someone from another congregation. You know, it's hard for a pastor to do this kind of thing. He can model it. He can encourage it. He's a key player, or she is a key player, in a communal decision process, discernment process. But it's great when other people stand up and say, I think we should do this. Here's how, here's why. You know. That's such a gift. Such a gift. I can remember going into a parish in Tacoma where they had to ask the pastor to resign because he stayed too long and then he sort of settled down and coasted. And he was just a dear man that everyone loved. And so I came as a pastor developer. That was my background. And this was a congregation in which the meeting age was probably 55 and there were about 12 children. 12 children. In a suburb, 12 children. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is wrong with the picture? And I knew it was going to be difficult. And so I went to the president of the congregation, Dan, and I said, you know, we have some people on the church council who shouldn't be on the council. They're not open to Christ, and they really don't want the congregation to grow. And he said, I'll knock them down, and you put the bandages on. In other words, I'll block for you. I'll block for you, so you won't have to take the heat. I'll be on point, but you be their priest. You be their pastor. What a gift that was. You know, here I am as a young pastor, you know, only about 8 years experience. And he said, if people really get nasty with you, I'll knock them down. You know. Now, you may disagree with that sort of style of ministry. But, I mean, he also could be very gentle, but he could be very direct and very firm. And he named baloney, baloney. And when someone was really being not in the spirit of Christ, he said, quit acting like a jerk. What if your pastor said to you, quit acting like a jerk? You know? Cut him off or cut her off, you know? Let me share with you a wonderful piece out of a book that's no longer in print. But my spiritual director kind of put me onto it. If you could take one per household, I would appreciate that because I want to leave some in the village for. And if you've got extras, you can just pass them to the front. This comes out of a book by Mary Bennett McKinney. And I am chagrined to admit that I had this book in my library and I gave it away because it looked boring. And I paid $30 to get this copy through a book finder, you know? And I thought, duh. You know? But she's a Benedictine. And she talks here about what does a pastor do, what does a facilitator do, and just says, oh, there's a lot of great, great nuggets, I think. Notice on top of page 43, I'm just going to highlight some things for you. If you've got a pencil or a pen, you can maybe, you know, put a dot or a star. Number six. A new understanding of the majority vote will need to be developed and internalized. It can no longer be the common understanding that the majority has won. This is really, I think, a great insight. Rather, it must reflect the Ignatian insight, the common understanding that the Spirit has been made manifest in the majority, and therefore all of us must accept the decision of the majority as the discerned decision that we now agree to embrace. On the next page, 44, top of the page, sharing the wisdom. Having reflected prayerfully and touched your own wisdom, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, each member must now share that wisdom with the total group and listen to the other members of the group as they share their wisdom. This is where analysis and synthesis takes place in group thinking. The effort here again is to try to hear the wisdom of the Spirit coming through the collective wisdom being shared in the group. I wish my present pastor could do this. I think she's going to be forced to leave because she's not doing this. And it's not all her fault, but she's having real trouble being collaborative in her ministry. 45, reflection on the data, the middle paragraph. The effort here is to study and reflect on the data in the light of your own lived experience. Trust the God of your experience. That's what Ignatius says. Praying through your feelings, your insights, your knowledge, your reactions. Don't edit them out. Don't censor them. Out of this prayerful reflection will come your piece of wisdom to share with the group. On the next page. Toward the bottom. The clearest way to test the degree of consensus is to just ask, if you were to vote on this issue now, given the ideas and the feelings you've heard from all of us, and matching the wisdom with your own, how would you vote? So before you vote, you sort of take a straw vote, you know, but you ask people, how does your wisdom mesh with the wisdom of the group? Next page, 47, the second paragraph on the bottom. Keep in mind that the ultimate goal in all of this is to let the discerning group arrive at a decision with which every member of the group will be able to live gracefully. Now, because of human sin, that doesn't happen. But that's a goal. That's a goal. That even if we differ, you know, even if you differ with your beloved, maybe pretty strongly, you don't leave the marriage. Even if you differ, you try and work it through. Sometimes you can't. Sometimes you can't. And certainly you don't want to be in a relationship that's abusive. Page 49, if you have a facilitator, the third paragraph on the right, where it says evaluation. The facilitator asked two questions. What was helpful, useful, good about the way we arrived at this decision? What was not helpful, useful, comfortable in the process? And I think this is real important. On the bottom of this page, and my when this was copied, it left off a line, so I want to give this to you because this is a key in the whole article. For a group to be about communal discernment, each member of the group must be walking with God. That's number one. That is committed to an openness to God, a trusting relationship. And then here's the rest of the sentence. That enables him or her to accept God's providence. To accept God's providence. And then a new sentence, the members of the group must also share, and then you go to the next page. So number one is everyone must be walking with God, committed to God, in a trusting relationship to accept how God calls it. Number two, the members of the group must also share commonality in understanding and affirming the goal or mission of the group. You know, if you don't agree with the mission of the group, problems. Three, and finally, each member must exhibit a trust and an honesty both in the preparation stage and in the sharing of wisdom. As listening to the Spirit in one's own heart and head is key to the preparation stage, listening is key in the conversation stage when you're making a communal decision. On the next page, 51. Top of the page, second paragraph. True discernment is not about winning or losing. Next paragraph. The discerning group must agree in advance that they will all be willing to accept the vote of the majority as the will of the Spirit. Let me say it another way. The minority must agree to agree with the majority, even though their insights were not the same. Instead of an attitude of we will do it this way because the majority want it this way, there will prevail an attitude of we will do it this way because the Holy Spirit has been heard through the majority. You know, sometimes the ELCA makes decisions nationally and people are unhappy and they say, well, that wasn't my decision. I wouldn't have voted that way. But do we listen to the Spirit in the larger church when we deal with problematic issues and key decisions about our theology or our mission? Or do we say my way, right or wrong, or the highway? Toward the bottom of that page, about the third paragraph, it's important to recognize pain and fear are operative in an individual who's disagreeing. In no way do we judge them unkindly or ridicule them or become impatient with them. Nor can we allow them to keep, and this is important, nor can we allow them to keep us from the will of the Spirit as discerned by the group. Sometimes you have those people who want to fix someone who's pouting. It's a great way to control a group if you're pouting or whining or silent, you know. The group must move on, providing whatever loving support and healing seems appropriate or possible. Please don't misunderstand what I'm trying to say. A general feeling of contentment and peace, that ability to accept the decision gracefully, is indeed an indicator of a discerned decision. My point is that it will not always be a unanimous experience. And then the last paragraph on page 53. There is nothing magical or miraculous about communal discernment. First of all, it's hard work. It takes all we have to give. This is important intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, physically, in terms of endurance. It calls for a great amount of humility and simplicity of heart, a willingness to struggle with oneself and one another. See, we speak the truth in love, even when we disagree. And perhaps more importantly, a willingness to grow on the part of everyone involved for the sake of the body. So, you know, we're almost out of time. One last question. Or shall we quit? Thank you. Peace be with you. You're welcome. And I hope maybe you can share this with other members of your community or your pastor or, you know, an ecumenical board you're on.
Is the whole book written with discussion?
Yes, it's amazing. It's amazing.
but it's no longer in print.
No, but you can get one
for
a price.
$30.
For a price. And my spiritual director copied me one chapter, and I was so intrigued with this chapter, I just said, I've got to find the book.
Try Amazon.
Yeah. Amazon, or there are some book finder groups out there. If you go on the web, that are amazing, and they'll tell you it's in excellent condition, or it's underlined. My copy's underlined, but anyway.
Thank you.